Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and look into the sudden reversal of 50 years of a failed policy with Cuba, where both President Obama and the Castro brothers have made statements calling for a new start in U.S.-Cuban relations. We'll be joined by Ambassador Wayne Smith, who is a veteran Cuba specialist at the Center for International Policy. He served with the Department of State in Havana, arriving there in August of 1958 and remaining there as the third Secretary for Political Affairs until the U.S. broke diplomatic relations in January of 1961. He was on the Cuba desk from 1964 to 1966 and was one of the first American diplomats to return to Cuba in 1977. From 1977 until 1979, he was the Director of Cuban Affairs in the Department of State and then became Chief of the U.S. Interest Section in Havana until 1982, when he left the Foreign Service over a disagreement on Cuba policy. We'll be joined later by Mike Chinoy, who's a senior fellow on Korean security at the Pacific Council on International Policy in Los Angeles. He has visited North Korea 14 times. He's the author of Meltdown, the Inside Story of the North Korea Crisis. And we'll be examining the latest escalation of tension on the Korean Peninsula with Mike Chinoy following the missile test by North Korea, which resulted in a unanimous condemnation by the UN Security Council. And then in the third segment of the first hour, we'll discuss the fallout from a Department of Homeland Security report on the threat of right-wing extremism in the United States, the growing threat, I should say. We'll be joined by Mark Potok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Let's begin now with the subject of Cuba. I'm joined again, as I mentioned, by Ambassador Wayne Smith, a veteran Cuba specialist at the Center for International Policy. He served with the State Department, arriving in Cuba in 1958, remaining there as the third Secretary for Political Affairs until U.S. broke diplomatic relations in January of 61. And he was on the Cuba desk from 64 to 66, and then was with a group of American diplomats returning to Cuba in 1977. From 1977 to 79, he was the Director of Cuban Affairs at the Department of State and then became Chief of the U.S. Interest Section in Havana until 1982, when he left the Foreign Service because of a disagreement over Cuba policy. So I guess it's taken, 50 years, right? did you think that this thing was kind of frozen in time and that Cuba policies was like something out of a Madame Tussauds wax museum?
Well, yes. I mean, we have never dealt really very rationally with Cuba. Nonetheless, I must say I'm surprised that here, 50 years later, I promised myself when I left the Foreign Service in 82 that I would not give up on it until there were normal relations between Cuba and the United States. Well, that's 27 years ago, and here we are. I hope that we're beginning to see a ray of light, a crack of light under the door, perhaps, but not all that certain.
Well, what we're told is that essentially, the United States was caught flat-footed and were surprised by Raul Castro's remarks, where he put everything on the table: human rights, freedom of the press, political prisoners. And, of course, this was a break from previous stances on the part of the Cubans. And then Fidel Castro echoed that in a speech he gave in Venezuela.
Or Raul Castro did, yeah.
I thought it was Fidel that...
Maybe it was.
Yes.
But he wasn't in Venezuela.
No, I thought Fidel was in Venezuela.
I don't think
speaking
so.
To a group of... I don't
think Fidel went to Venezuela. Oh. I'm not certain anyway. Someone made it.
Okay. Well, the long and the short of it is that this... Well, having studied this forever, having been there, having been the U.S. representative there at the intersection... What do you make of it? Is this really quite as big as it's advertised in terms of a game changer?
It could be. Look, I'll tell you what I think happened. I think that Obama took this very small step of lifting restrictions on the travel and remittances of Cuban Americans. and then said the next step is up to the Cubans. They can release political prisoners and so forth. That will never work. If you go to the Cubans and you say, first you must release your political prisoners and then we can talk, it's the best way to make certain that the political prisoners are not released and that you never talk, because they will not accept preconditions. But, and I thought that perhaps was why Obama was saying, you know, the next step is up to you, such as releasing political prisoners and so forth, and that would end the whole operation. But rather than that, Raul Castro came back and said, we're willing to talk and everything can be on the table, as long as we're mutually respectful towards one another. We're equals. We're negotiating as, or we're talking as equals, but we can talk about it. Well, that's different. They're not saying they're going to release prisoners. They're saying they'll talk about it, and I'm sure if talks do begin on something like releasing political prisoners, the Cubans will say, well, look, you know, there are two sides to this. First of all, many of these guys are in jail because the Bush administration came forward with an objective to overthrow our government and said that one of its means of doing so was to give money to these guys, to the dissidents. And so many of them did end up in jail. Now, is that still your policy, and are you still funding these guys? Also, what about the Cuban Five, the five Cubans who are held here? In other words, there are two sides to it, and there can be some back and forth, and so the Cubans are willing to talk about it. What comes out of it, that's difficult to know, but at least they're saying they're willing to talk, and today, in his remarks at the summit, President Obama was rather indicating that we would be willing to talk as well, without steps on the Cubans' part before.
Well, clearly, the embargo has been probably one of the biggest foreign policy failures in U.S. diplomatic history, perhaps eclipsed by George W. Bush's blunder in Iraq. But nevertheless, there's a universal agreement that it's been a total failure.
Of course.
What does appear to be really where the real action is, though, is the remittances of money from Cuban Americans in Florida and New Jersey and in other parts of the United States. How does that affect it? Because clearly the embargo has become irrelevant because other people, including the Canadians, trade with Castro. So what about the remittance issue? Is that, and
now,
the idea that you'll let more people go, presumably that's one of the first things that will happen. How's that going to affect things?
Yeah, look, I would say that remittances, travel in general, when some of the other governments and people at the summit were saying, well, you must lift the embargo. I don't think the Cubans always talk about the embargo and it should be lifted and so forth, but if the embargo is lifted or not, as long as the remittances are coming, and if they lift travel controls, which they may do, I mean, I say they, the Congress, there are bills before both the House and Senate to lift travel controls on all Americans so that all Americans could travel down there. That also would bring a lot of money into Cuba. I think the Cubans probably don't care much about the embargo. They always use it as an excuse. You know, anytime someone says the economy's not doing well, if it weren't for the embargo, it would be doing fine. That's if you can trade with every other country in the world except the United States, even though the United States is a powerful country economically, the embargo's not going to affect you that much, and it doesn't. It's an inconvenience.
Well, many people have suggested over the years that the embargo has done little but keep the Castro brothers in power because it's provided them with a perfect excuse for everything that goes wrong and for the deprivations that their people go through, which is largely because of the misgovernance of the communist regime. And I get the impression that what Obama's doing is actually very clever in the sense that he's refusing to be the enemy, which is going to completely undercut both the Castro brothers and Chavez, for that matter, who is a professional anti-American.
Well, he's not playing the role of the enemy, saying we're willing to talk, but so far, he really hasn't done anything.
Give him a day or so, Wayne.
But I mean, I'm really frustrated. There's so many things that we should be doing to change, let's say, the outline of our policy. We still have the outline of the policy of George Bush, but there's so many things that we could do very easily, such as having our interest sections begin to talk to the host government again. The Cuban interest section here hasn't been able to have a normal diplomatic conversation with the State Department for years. Same with our interest section in Havana. They're not allowed to have normal diplomatic conversations with the Cubans. The State Department tells them they can't. All sorts of things that we should be doing to signal that we are changing horses. We're changing policies, but we haven't done any of them.
Is that TV Marti still broadcasting, by the way?
Absolutely. That's one. TV Marti is still broadcasting. No one ever sees it.
Right.
But it's still going. We're still wasting money on it. And I haven't seen a word out of the Obama administration about closing it down.
Well, you'd think that at the very least we could save a few bucks there because it's a
Absolutely.
Total waste of time.
Sure.
And
sure.
It's only there as a sop to the right-wing Cuban community.
Right.
But back to Castro, because the meeting, the handshake between Obama and Castro and Chavez, I should say, made the front pages of many newspapers. And then later the next day, apparently, Hugo Chavez handed President Obama a Spanish-language copy of a book, The Open Veins of Latin America, Five Centuries of the Pillage of a Continent, by Eduardo Galeano. Apparently, it's as a result of that, it's gone from 600 and something on the Amazon, or 6,000 and something on the Amazon list, up to number 14.
Yeah,
so he's actually, I think, a credible political scientist, isn't he, Galeano?
I haven't read it, but my understanding is that he is, yes.
Yeah. So I guess Obama thought that Chavez was giving him a copy of his book, which is what happened to him in Mexico. Everybody came up with the copies of Obama's book wanting it autographed. But given how stupid the Bush administration have been over Chavez and have again provided him with a convenient enemy, which he continually blames the U.S. for everything that goes wrong in Venezuela, and particularly for his excuse for grabbing as much power as he can, it's pretty clear that this new approach is fairly disarming. I mean, he also met with the Colombian writer as well, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and that apparently, although the LA Times characterized it in a rather unnecessarily snide way, they referred to Obama as fawning over Marquez.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm
it's unfortunate.
Yeah, because it seems like Obama had genuine respect for him and had read all his books.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is what
I mean, Garcia Marquez is a great writer.
Right. So what's wrong with people just behaving like human beings, you know?
Right. Exactly. You're right about the disarming, though. If Obama is taking a somewhat more conciliatory tone towards Chavez, and today, in his closing remarks at the press conference in the summit, even towards Raul Castro, then sort of the demon goes out of the window and it becomes more difficult to use the U.S. as the boogeyman that everyone has to be prepared against or to defend against. But it's an intelligent position for him to take. I just wish he would do more.
Right.
Put substance to it.
So what do you think, since you know the Castro brothers, what do you think is going on there? Because I can't imagine these two old Stalinists have really changed their stripes. They want to hold on forever, and they like it the way it is. I can't see how you can reconcile opening up more trade, more particularly the influx of families reuniting, more money coming in. There's already a peculiar two-tiered economy, a dollar economy, the local economy, which are miles apart, and it's created a kind of economic apartheid there. So just give us a sense in closing here, Ambassador Wayne Smith, how this could be navigated.
Well, look, the Castros may not like it, but they need the money. Cuba is in difficult straits, and they need the remittances that the Cuban Americans can send, and they would also need the dollars that American tourists could bring. But you're right, if you have an influx of Americans, and you have Cuban Americans coming in, and look, now Cuban Americans can take down as much money as they want. They can begin to invest, not themselves, but they give the money to their relatives to invest in various things, open up little restaurants and that kind of thing. So it does begin to change the atmosphere and makes it far more difficult. In fact, I would say makes it impossible to keep the economy in the straitjacket it's in now. It will help to loosen it up. The Castros may not like it, but they need the money, and so it's likely to happen.
But this is not, we're not talking about democracy here. We're just talking...
No. We're talking about loosening up the economy.
Right.
Loosening up the economy, and as you loosen up the economy, that does bring pressures for people to have a greater say in how they run their individual economies.
Right. And of course, this could have been done 50 years ago, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way it seems. I mean, what in God's name have we got out of it? What does it say about Washington? In other words, once a policy's in place, it just becomes kind of petrified?
That's true with Cuba. Cuba has a strange effect on American governments. It goes all the way back to the 19th century, when we thought that Cuba should, as the rightful order of things, Cuba would become part of the Union. That's the way it should be. And then it didn't become part of the Union. They insisted on being somewhat independent. We imposed the Platt Amendment, which in 1902, which turned Cuba into an American protectorate. But still, they were independent. But we still had the idea they should do what we wanted them to. And, you know, I think we can deal with China, another communist country. We have perfectly normal diplomatic and trade relations with Vietnam, against which we fought a very bloody and divisive war. But we can deal normally with them. But until now, at least, not with Cuba. Cuba is different. Cuba, as far as some American politicians are concerned, should still be under the Platt Amendment.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Ambassador Wayne Smith.
A pleasure. Yeah, I enjoyed the talk.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Ambassador Wayne Smith, who's a veteran Cuba specialist at the Center for International Policy. He served with the Department of State in Havana, arriving there in August of 1958 and remaining there as the third Secretary of Political Affairs until the U.S. broke diplomatic relations in January of 1961. He was on the Cuba desk from 1964 to 66, and he was with the first group of diplomats to return to Cuba in 1977. And from 1977 to 1979, he was the Director of Cuban Affairs at the Department of State, and then became the Chief of the U.S. Interest Section in Havana in 1982. I'm now speaking with Mike Chenoy, who's a Senior Fellow at the Pacific Council on International Policy in Los Angeles, and the author of the recently published book Meltdown, the Inside Story of the North Korean Nuclear Crisis. And Mike has visited North Korea 14 times, which I think is a pretty unique record for any American, Mike. The latest escalations on the peninsula, of course, were provoked by North Korea firing off a missile test, which did get unanimous condemnation from the UN Security Council. Some of the rhetoric, I know it's always been sort of colorful and somewhat hysterical, that comes out of North Korea. I don't know how you take it, but let me just quote some of the statements in the last couple of days from North Korea. When a nuclear war will break out, that's a pretty scary thing. When a nuclear war will break out due to the war chariot of the South Korea-U.S. military alliance is a matter of time. The U.S. and South Korea warmongers would be well advised to stop acting rashly, properly understanding who their rival is. So is that saber-rattling meant for us or for internal consumption?
Well, it's meant for both, and it fits a long-standing pattern of North Korean behavior. Bellicose rhetoric is their stock in trade. You can go back through any number of moments in the last many years and find the North Koreans using that kind of language. In 1994, for example, in March of that year, a North Korean official threatened a South Korean official that the North would turn the South Korean capital, Seoul, into, quote, a sea of fire. And yet, 3 months later, the North Koreans were receiving former U.S. President Jimmy Carter. And 4 months after that, they'd signed a deal called the Agreed Framework, under which they froze their nuclear program. So it needs to be analyzed carefully, but also not taken literally at face value.
Well, in your book, Mike Chinoy, Meltdown, The Inside Story of the North Korean Nuclear Crisis, you talk about how the relations were improved under Clinton, albeit there was almost a war in 1994, which I'd like to talk to you about further. But you did go into the rather sorry record of the Bush administration, where essentially we had counterintuitive policies which allowed them to actually build a nuclear weapon. You argue that President Bush made decisions based on emotion instead of reason.
I think the record of the Bush administration is a pretty sorry one, by and large, when it comes to North Korea. The Clinton administration had all kinds of ups and downs with the North Koreans as well. But at the end of the Clinton administration, there was a serious review of U.S. policy that Bill Clinton had carried out by his former Defense Secretary William Perry, who went to North Korea. Following that, the North Koreans sent a senior envoy to Washington who actually met with Clinton, and that led to Secretary of State Madeleine Albright visiting Pyongyang in October of 2000, and the North Koreans inviting Clinton himself to come to the North Korean capital and hold a summit with the North Korean leader Kim Jong-il. That didn't happen for a variety of reasons, not least the disputed 2000 election here. But the Bush administration inherited a dynamic in which the North Koreans were hoping for significant progress in a rapprochement with the United States. I think it's important to understand that since at least the early 90s, the North Korean leadership's key strategic goal has been regime survival in a hostile world in which all the other main communist allies of North Korea over many decades had collapsed, East Germany, the Soviet Union, and so on. And they saw the way to get that to have a political accommodation with the United States. That was the way the North saw its own security could be guaranteed. And so for a couple of years after the Bush administration took office, the North continued to try and pursue engagement with the United States. But because of the dominance of the neoconservative group in the new Bush administration, and also because of the impact of September 11th, you had a very, very hardline response. You had the Axis of Evil speech, in which North Korea was lumped in with Iran and Iraq. You had arguments for pressure and sanctions. And that ultimately created a situation in which the North restarted its frozen nuclear program. And it wasn't until after the North staged a nuclear test in 2006 that the Bush administration reversed course and began to engage seriously with North Korea and began to hold negotiations, which led to a significant rollback in the operations of the North's main nuclear facility at Yongbyon. But continued internal infighting, which I document in great and often colorful detail in my book Meltdown, between the so-called hardliners and those who wanted to engage North Korea, really crippled the Bush administration's ability to deal with the North Koreans. And it's partly this legacy of distrust and suspicion on the North Korean side when they look at American behavior is shaping some of what North Korea is doing now with the new Obama administration.
So I guess it's easy to demonize North Korea, but the point is that once you've got past saying how terrible they are, and they really are a terrible regime, the adult thing is essentially you have to deal with them. I mean, that's the bottom line, and it seems to be that we've sort of gone the rhetorical route without doing the heavy lifting. They keep wanting to steer us off the six-party agenda, which the UN Security Council's resolution condemning them, is an attempt to put them back on that track. Why is it that the North Koreans want to deal directly with the United States? Is it just the notion that by doing so, they're insulting the so-called South Korean puppet? Is that their motive?
No, I think, and this is based in part on a lot of discussions I've had with North Korean officials over my many visits there. The North Korean worldview is that it's the U.S. that is both the sole superpower and also it's the country that is the source of North Korea's problems. The North Koreans see the division of the Korean Peninsula as having been done by the United States. It was the U.S. that was the North Central adversary. And so they feel that in order to sort things out, it's the U.S. that's the problem, and therefore the U.S. That is the solution. Now, Washington's counter to that, certainly in the Bush administration, was that this is a regional issue and you need to get all the regional players involved. And at some point, you do. But the North Koreans say that over many years that the reason they have developed a missile capability was in large part because of concerns over feeling threatened by the United States. And they've explicitly said that the reason they've developed this nuclear capability is because they feel threatened by the United States. Again, a look back at the history, which I chronicle in my book Meltdown, is very, very instructive here. When George W. Bush took office, the North Koreans had enough weapons-grade plutonium to make one or perhaps two nuclear bombs, although even that is not certain. And it was in the context of the Axis of Evil speech, the Bush administration's doctrine of preemptive regime change, which was exemplified by the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the toppling of Saddam Hussein. It was in that context that the North Koreans restarted their nuclear program because they felt, and I've had North Korean officials say this explicitly to me, that Saddam Hussein was first and Kim Jong-il is going to be next, and we're not going to let that happen. And so a deal under which the North's security concerns vis-a-vis the United States are addressed is what they have been looking for. I think, however, a couple of important things have happened recently. The most important was the 2006 nuclear test, which again did not take place in a vacuum but was a response to a refusal by the Bush administration to deal with them diplomatically in the previous year, and also a response to U.S. efforts to sanction them financially by targeting a bank in the former Portuguese territory of Macau, where the North Koreans held many accounts. But once that nuclear test took place, there was kind of a psychological change on the North Korean side in that they now say they are a nuclear power and the starting point of any future negotiations is that they have to be accepted as such. And there's very little precedent for a country that staged a nuclear test to roll that back. But they've done everything they've done on the nuclear front, they say, in response to this sense of being threatened by the United States. And so they have consistently, for all of their bellicose rhetoric, been signaling that's the point of departure. If there is going to be any kind of diplomatic resolution of this issue, it has to be some kind of accommodation with the U.S. And I think much of what we've seen from North Korea in recent months has been designed to strengthen their position if there is an eventual resumption of negotiations.
Again, I'm speaking with Mike Chinoy, who's a senior fellow at the Pacific Council on International Policy in Los Angeles and the author of the recently published book, Meltdown, The Inside Story of the North Korean Nuclear Crisis. And Mike Chinoy has visited North Korea 14 times. Were you there in 1994 when apparently we came close to war during the Clinton administration? Jimmy Carter apparently had a hand in averting the crisis, or at least dampening it down. And he apparently used CNN, or used the threat of going live on CNN as a weapon to force Clinton to back down. Is that Am I getting it right?
Pretty much. Again, it's something I talk about in my book, Meltdown, because I was at that time a correspondent for CNN and was the only reporter who traveled with Carter to North Korea. It was a kind of there are some eerie parallels with the dynamic we've seen today. The U.S. was angry at what it saw as North Korea's efforts to move ahead on its nuclear program and was threatening to go to the United Nations for sanctions. The North Koreans said they would consider that an act of war. That's the same kind of language that they've used recently. And the Clinton administration made serious preparations for a preemptive strike on North Korea's nuclear facilities. And in this extremely tense situation, former President Carter wrangled an invitation and went to Pyongyang, and I went along with him, and he met several times with the North Korean leader at the time, Kim Il-sung, the father of the current leader, Kim Jong-il, and in effect drove a compromise under which the North Koreans agreed to freeze their nuclear activity if the U.S. would back off this push from sanctions. And he announced that the North Koreans had agreed to this on CNN, even though the U.S. government had not agreed, but he kind of boxed the Clinton administration in to the point that the administration had to go along with it with some unhappiness. But the upshot was a series of negotiations which began a couple of weeks later and led within 3 or 4 months to the so-called agreed framework of October 1994, under which the North froze activity at its Yongbyon nuclear power facility. And in return, there was the North Koreans were supposed to get shipments of fuel oil and two safer light water nuclear reactors. And that agreement was implemented in fits and starts, but I think there's no question that had it not happened, when the new crisis erupted under the Bush administration, the North, had it not shut down and frozen its nuclear activities in 94, could have had enough plutonium for 40 or 50 bombs as the point of departure rather than one or two. And we've seen now that the North has enough plutonium for 5 or 6 bombs, how worrisome that is. So you can imagine what it's like if they had 4 or 5 times as many.
Well, Mike, you know, it seems to me that the idea of regime change might be a bit of a pipe dream here, even though people despise this leadership and what he does to his country and his countrymen. My understanding is that there really isn't much military solution to this situation. And it is a hair trigger situation, and people are rightly concerned. However, I understand that what the regime is most vulnerable to is South Korean soap operas that are smuggled across the Chinese border, and that the people who live in this kind of metal cocoon that the Kims have imposed on them from birth to death, see how the rest of the world lives and recognize that there's something wrong now. Am I right in suggesting that those kind of methods of undoing the regime from within, with what's loosely called soft power, if there is a way to get rid of this regime, that would be the way, that any military option is pretty much dead on arrival or suicidal?
I think that the idea of a military option is a complete non-starter, and one of the things that became clear as I did the research for my book, Meltdown, and talking to people who were deeply involved in making of Bush administration North Korea policy, was that when they talked about pressure and coercion and sanctions to weaken, undermine the regime, the North Korean system is one in which the leadership doesn't really care about the plight of its own people, and so it is, in a sense, not going to be responsive to sanctions or coercion. And the reality is that since the U.S. doesn't know where the nuclear bombs are hidden, and since the North Koreans have thousands of artillery tubes that could turn the South Korean capital, Seoul, into a sea of fire within a few minutes, and they have missiles that could reach targets in Japan or possibly beyond, there's no credibility to the military option. And the history has shown that sanctions and coercion don't produce a change in North Korean behavior along the lines the U.S. wants, but rather the North Koreans tend to do the opposite. And I think the pattern has been seen over and over. And there's an element of that, frankly, with the missile test, because it is in part a response to the North Korean perception that they were promised last year a number of things from the United States, and because of the divisions in the Bush administration, there were delays or inconsistencies. They thought that they would quickly get off the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism, but the Bush administration announced plans to do so and then held off and then tried to condition that on demanding additional North Korean concessions on verifying details of their nuclear program that weren't written down in the earlier agreement. And then the South Koreans have been delaying and continue to delay giving North Korea promised shipments of heavy fuel oil that were part of the deal under which they were disabling their nuclear reactor. So playing tough with the North Koreans, generally, the history has shown, and it was clear in my book Meltdown, doesn't work. But your point about the North Koreans being more vulnerable to soft power is very true. This is a regime in which people have been isolated from the rest of the world, and I think there is a very strong argument that if you hold your nose and engage with these people and gradually over time expose them to South Korean soap operas, to the notion that there are other better ways of doing things in other countries in the region with a higher standard of living, you can begin to erode some of the worst aspects of North Korea and undermine the ability of the system to maintain its grip. And that, I think, cuts to the core of one of the more interesting questions with North Korea is, will they or won't they ever adopt the Chinese model of market-style economic reforms? I think there are people in North Korea who realize they need to do so to revive their economy, but it would indeed undermine this personality cult-based dictatorship. So that is, if there is an Achilles heel in North Korea, it's that one, and that requires contact and exchanges that also require a sense of legitimizing the regime in the process because they control the doors. But if you can get things in the doors, it could have an impact. You're right.
Well, just in closing then, Mike Chinoy, how can the United States get China to be more cooperative? Because clearly China has more leverage with North Korea than any other country. I can't imagine, for example, the Chinese really do want North Korea to collapse and the South Korea to, in effect, the United States military to be sitting on the Yellow River as they were when China entered the Korean War. So, and I understand also that the South Koreans would love to have a train or any kind of route from South Korea across North Korea into China, which has become one of their biggest markets. So, give us a sense of how what's China's agenda here?
Well, American policymakers in the United States during the Bush administration and even now have looked to China as a key player, and China is indeed a key player. Most of North Korea's trade and fuel and aid goes through China. The two countries have this relationship going back to having been allies in the Korean War against the United States and South Korea. And China has two different sets of interests here. They clearly don't want North Korea to become a nuclear power, particularly if that prompts Japan, which is China's regional rival, to consider changing its own pacifist defense policies and going nuclear itself. On the other hand, the more immediate Chinese concern and the greater Chinese priority is to prevent instability in North Korea. The Chinese are very focused on their own economic development. Instability that it would involve a huge influx of starving North Korean refugees into China or turmoil or conflict inside North Korea, particularly a series of events in which the U.S. or South Korea might be tempted to intervene militarily, is the ultimate nightmare for the Chinese. The conclusion, therefore, is that the Chinese, while they will express disapproval of the North Koreans, as they did by supporting the recent UN Security Council president's statement criticizing Pyongyang's missile test, are not going to take steps to bring the North Korean regime to its knees. And any American notions that you can rely on the Chinese to bring the North Koreans around doesn't hold water. The Chinese want to see the U.S. and the North Koreans talking to each other, trying to work out some kind of negotiated accommodation, and they will play a role of facilitator, and they will certainly express their disapproval of the North Koreans, but they are not going to take the kind of steps that some in Washington in the previous administration and perhaps in this administration hope to bring the North Koreans around to meet American demands.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles today, Mike Chinoy.
Thanks very much.
Again, Mike Chinoy is a senior fellow at the Pacific Council on International Policy in Los Angeles, the author of the recently published book, Meltdown, the Inside Story of the North Korean Nuclear Crisis, and he's visited North Korea 14 times. Let's now turn to the subject of right-wing extremism here in the United States. I'm speaking with Mark Potok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. And Mark, clearly the Department of Homeland Security's release of this unclassified version of a report that came from their Office of Intelligence and Analysis about right-wing extremism, citing it as the most dangerous domestic terrorist threat in the United States, has created quite a flurry of indignation in conservative circles. And just given the press coverage of it, do you think the somehow the message here has been lost?
Oh, I think that this is an absolute tempest in a teacup. You know, the kind of cries from the right have been that this document defames all conservatives and war veterans, of all things. And when one really reads the document, it doesn't remotely say that. The word conservative never even appears. And really what it says about war veterans is that white supremacists are interested in attempting to recruit returning veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq. It doesn't say anything about, you know, these veterans are real amenable to this kind of ideology or anything like that. But the fury has been quite amazing.
Well, the New York Times did publish a list of returning veterans who had joined these various right-wing groups. Now, I take it these are the groups that you study. That's really what you do professionally.
That's true. And we had pointed out this problem of extremists in the military some 3 years ago. We put out a major report in 2006. What the Times columnist did was an interesting graphic illustration of what, in fact, was an FBI report on the very same matter from late last fall, extremists in the American military.
So can you give us an idea of the numbers and the diversity of these groups and what, well, not just the diversity of these groups, but also what binds them together? What is their common ideology, if any?
Well, I mean, we have seen a real growth over the last 7 or 8 years of white supremacist and other radical right-wing groups. By our count, some 54% rise in the number of these groups. You know, they range from Klan groups to neo-Nazi groups to extreme anti-gay groups. You know, we have tax protest groups and so on. We also, there's also a fairly significant subset of black supremacist groups. Virtually all of those sectors have been growing going back to around the year 2000. And really what is interesting is that they have grown almost entirely on the backs of on the back of their exploitation of the immigration issue, which is, in fact, precisely what the DHS document points out. Additionally, there are two other important factors, the rise of Barack Obama, a black man, to the White House, of course, and also the economy, which seems to be beginning to play. These are all mentioned in the DHS report. We had put out an extremely similar report, actually, back in February. So from my own point of view, the DH document is a perfectly calm, rational assessment of what's really going on out there.
Well, there is, of course, though, a history of these documents having a political bias. During the Bush administration, they didn't ever release any documents criticizing or singling out white supremacists and other right-wing movements. However, they did single out left-wing groups such as the Animal Liberation Front and the Earth Liberation Front.
That's absolutely true. The FBI, on several occasions, testified to Congress that the number one domestic terrorist threat, quote-unquote, was from what they called eco-terrorists. And I must say, it seemed very out of sync with reality indeed, in the sense that certainly there are people out there, you know, carrying out these extreme actions like firebombing the homes of UCLA researchers and so on. And I think just as certainly they will kill somebody one of these days. But to compare that to the radical right, to the white supremacist right, which, among other things, you know, murdered 168 people in Oklahoma City in 1995, I think is just absurd.
Well, here I am at what's considered a left-wing radio station, and I'm pretty familiar with every variety of the tortured coalition on the left, or the lack thereof. And I've never thought for one minute that the animal liberation people and the earth liberation people were leftists. I mean, where does that come from?
Oh, who's to say? You know, I guess because many of them are kind of loosely associated with the anarchist scene, that, you know, that's the way they're characterized.
Oh, I see.
I think a better description is they're single issue extremists, if you want to call them that.
Right. Well, Mark Potok, again, I'm speaking with Mark Potok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, and he tracks right-wing groups in this country. And we're talking about the Department of Homeland Security's recently released declassified version of a report on right-wing extremism that was compiled by DHS's Office of Intelligence and Analysis, which has created a backlash in conservative circles of indignation. But in terms of facts, just absolutely unassailable facts, since President Obama has been elected, 7 million people have applied for criminal background checks to get firearms, and that doesn't include Virginia, where gun shows don't require a background check. And also, there's a number of reports that people are stockpiling ammunition, and that many gun shops are out of assault weapons because there's a prevailing urban myth in NRA circles, if you will, that somehow people are going to lose their assault rifles.
Yeah, even though Obama has made no sounds about gun control whatsoever. I mean, let me just say that, you know, the kind of fake fury that has been generated on the right over this report has reached really kind of astounding proportions. Another California radio host, the right-winger Michael Savage, you know, has the third largest radio audience in America, last week went after me personally because he decided that, you know, I was sort of sliming conservatives and veterans and so on. And the language was quite amazing. You know, I was called a hater of America, a communist slime bag, a piece of garbage. I'd like to spit in his face, you know, he said. You know, this to millions and millions of people. And in fact, the result for us was that on Thursday and Friday, we got a small avalanche of hate mail, email threats, calls. You know, I've actually had to have a uniformed police officer put out front of my car, of my house, rather. So, you know, it's a rather amazing scene that has been drummed up on the basis of virtually nothing.
Now, how did Michael Savage, what did he quote that could possibly suggest that you are what he said on the air?
Well, his idea is that, you know, we are the wicked hand behind the Department of Homeland Security, that this report wasn't a DHS report at all, that, you know, we've somehow, you know, run the government, I guess, secretly and have put this thing out. And that, you know, and then he goes on without quoting the report at all to say that it's an attack on all conservatives, that it's an attack on veterans, you know, it's an attack on any patriotic American. And, you know, again, I would very much urge listeners to go up on the Internet where this report is all over the place and take a look. It just doesn't say anything like that. And I think it's a crazy, paranoid misreading of the document that we're hearing about.
Well, from what you're telling me, Mark Potok, I think you can make the case, the opposite case, that if they're attacking the Southern Poverty Law Center and now you have to have police protection because of Michael Savage's rants, hate-filled rants, which, of course, is a projection of his hatred because he's saying that you hate Americans when when he's the kind of a poster boy of hate radio. The main, people remember the Southern Poverty Law Center for, I think, mostly, is that you guys put the Klan out of business. So what's going on here? Are these kind of, you know, sort of sentimental sentimentalists for bringing back the Klan? I mean, or quasi-apologists? I mean,
who's to say? I think what we're really seeing, though, is a kind of hysterical reaction from the kind of far right within the Republican Party. I mean, over the last couple of weeks, we've seen, you know, and I think these are people who feel that their party is falling apart. They've lost any connection to real power. So, you know, how that manifests itself in the public square is we see people like Glenn Beck, who is a Fox News Channel host, saying or speculating that FEMA is running, secret concentration camps in which to put patriotic Americans. The same fellow has described President Obama as a Nazi and a fascist and a Marxist. I guess all those things are the same in his mind. Last week in his rant, Michael Savage described the president as President Mao-bama. And it goes on from there. There just seems to be this very hysterical reaction to, I guess, the feeling of the loss of power on the far right of the Republican Party.
And I suppose to some extent that was manifested in the teabag demonstrations this week that took place on Tax Day. Last Wednesday, there were a number of signs held up that were racist, unequivocally, and hate-filled. Perhaps the media did focus on them, and it gave a distorted view of things. But we've also had some people who one would expect to be reasonably responsible, like the governor of Texas, Rick Perry, who recently made charges that Mexican drug wars would cross the border. And, of course, El Paso, which is right across the border from Juarez, which is where thousands of Mexicans have been killed in this drug war. El Paso has the lowest crime rate in the United States, so there's no evidence of that. So he's already done some demagoguing on that issue, but now he's talking about perhaps Texas seceding, which, of course, provoked a civil war in this country's history. Just a political question along those lines, and I know you try to stay out of politics. You just deal with the facts, Mark Potok. But I'm just wondering how you can, given the power of the NRA in this country, the fact that Obama doesn't want to take them on, Dianne Feinstein publicly said this week that she's no way in the world is she going to try and take on the NRA and put forth a renewal of the ban on assault weapons. So how, in that climate, does Obama satisfy pressure from Mexico, who are saying, all the guns that are killing our police and civilians in this war that's going on south of the border come from the United States? So how do you navigate that?
I don't know how. I mean, I think something that is really worth pointing out is, the voices that we're hearing from that you've just mentioned, the Texas governor and the NRA, are really, quite something. I mean, when Governor Perry talks about Texas possibly seceding, he is sounding an echo of kind of the worst of the militia movement during the 1990s in Texas, in which a really radical group called the Republic of Texas tried to get the state to secede. That ultimately ended in a huge armed standoff on the Davis Mountains near El Paso in far west Texas. In which a person was killed, a couple was taken hostage. I was actually there as a reporter when this occurred. In the end, when the cops moved in, the Republic of Texas people had set booby traps in an attempt to murder officers of the Texas Rangers. So, that's a hell of a thing for the governor to be suggesting. The NRA, it's good to remember that back then in the 90s, the NRA talked about federal agents from the ATF, from the FBI, as jackbooted thugs, people who were coming to break down the doors of good patriotic Americans and do them in one way or another. So, it is a shame, is all I can say, that those, lobbies of that sort or people who make these kinds of noises are taken seriously to the point where, some kind of reasonable attempt at gun control, is seen as some sort of fascist move. And as you say, frighten senators and congressmen off.
Well, just in closing, Mark Potok, you mentioned that the police are the victims of these right-wing extremists, and the police normally are considered a fairly conservative block of Americans. They're certainly not liberals. What kind of political weight do they have? I mean, think about what just happened in Pittsburgh. Three police officers were gunned down by a right-wing white supremacist who had this delusion that Obama was going to take away assault rifles. So he takes out his weird political delusion on peace officers who he guns down at point-blank range. And, you know, my feeling is that the best allies we have left in this country for sensible gun control are the police.
I think that's quite right. I think it's not unfair to say that as a group we're talking about fairly conservative men and women, but they understand as a general matter better than anyone just how deadly these people can be. The shooter in Pittsburgh was a man who was had completely imbibed the ideas of, you know, the Jews are running our society, and so on. I mean, he had essentially adopted neo-Nazi ideology and posted a great deal of material to that effect. You know, there have been something on the order of 25 police officers murdered by right-wing extremists in this country since the Oklahoma City bombing. Back in 1995. So it's interesting, even as we talked a little earlier about the FBI under the Bush administration, its top officials saying that eco-terrorism, quote-unquote, was the real threat, I think that's never been the feeling, or at least since Oklahoma, of most officers and federal agents who really work, who are on the streets, who actually work these cases. I think they know quite well what's out there.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Mark Potok.
Well, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Ian, take care.
Well, actually, I think Mark Potok should take care if he's got a policeman outside his door because of the rantings of that poisonous little weasel, Michael Savage. Again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just talking then with Mark Potok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Report. He also puts out their Hate Watch blog, and he's been a key spokesman for the Southern Poverty Law Center, a well-known civil rights organization in Alabama. He's testified before the United States Senate, the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights, and other venues. I'd like to thank the producer, Lewis Vandenberg, the associate producer, Elliot Fong, the assistant producer, Janie Coolidge, Jazz Shepherd, the engineer,